Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are going to have a fascinating, thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast today with my guest, Dr. Brock Hollett. He has a brand new book, Debunking Preterism, How Overrealized Eschatology Misses the Not Yet of Bible Prophecy. If that sounds a little complicated, we'll unpack it for you. For those familiar with it, you know exactly what we're talking about. Here's the number to call. If you have a question for my guest, 866-348-7884. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Before I get into a definition of terms and things like that, I want to share something very interesting about Dr. Hollett's background. He's a medical doctor with an MDiv degree, so he's got a theological degree and is working towards a PhD interdisciplinary studies, Jewish studies he's focusing on as well. But he was a committed preterist. So when we talk about a preterist means past. Things happened in the past. And the view would be a full preterist view that when the Bible talks about the return of Jesus, Jesus coming soon, Jesus coming quickly, that it refers to his coming in judgment, bringing destruction on the temple of Jerusalem, and many would say bringing to an end the covenant with Israel because of Israel's failure. And the most radical preterists would even say that there's no future second coming, that we're already living in the new heavens and the new earth, that we consistently say the book of Revelation is to be dated before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which goes against the vast majority of biblical scholars. There are a lot of other implications to this, but Dr. Hollett was a committed preterist and was about to publish a book on preterism when something very interesting happened. So, Dr. Hollett, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
All right, just need make sure our connection is good and you're speaking directly into the phone so we can hear you clearly. Tell us what happened, why you became convinced of preterism, and what happened when you were about to publish your book on it.
Okay. So I was studying at a seminary, working on a Master of Divinity at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City. That was about 18 years ago. And I really became convinced of the preterist perspective at that time as I was confronted with what we would classically call the time statements of the New Testament. The statements that Jesus and the apostles made about the return of Jesus or the coming of Jesus being soon, near, and at hand. I was presented with some preterist arguments at that time that essentially said that that proved that Jesus promised to return or at least to come in some kind of judgment coming to his contemporary audience or to that, if you will, generation of time.
Right. So the book of Revelation, this is written to show it must soon take place. Jesus says, I'm coming quickly, I'm coming soon. So in order for those passages to have any kind of serious meaning, then you were convinced it couldn't mean he's coming 2,000 years later. If I say, hey, listen, we're going to call you back very soon to get a new connection, and we don't call you back for 300 years, you could say, well, obviously you didn't do it. So that was a persuasive argument to you, and that's why you began to buy into the position.
Yes. I think this is where a lot of people fall into preterism based mm-hmm. on these particular arguments.
All right. So that was kind of the hook that drew you in interpretively, exegetically. And then from there, how is it that you became such a serious proponent of it? And who would you say were the major teachers you were listening to?
Sure. I think initially the teachers that were most persuasive to me would be teachers such as Gary DeMar, Kim Gentry, also other teachers like R.C. Sproul, which many of the audience should be familiar with, Hank Hanegraaff, formerly Bible Answer Man. NT Wright, more on the academic side of things. And as I began researching this more and more and became convinced of the preterist way of interpreting Scripture, the preterist hermeneutic, if you will, the authors by...
Tell you what, hang on. We are losing our connection here by the moment. So Howard is just going to jump back on with you, Brock, and we'll do our best to get this connection established better. So Howard, go here. Take it from here. See if we can get a better line to connect with. All right. So here's what happens. Dr. Hollett becomes convinced that there is scriptural evidence for preterism, that we must completely revise our thinking, our paradigm. And instead of looking forward for Jesus coming soon, every generation says Jesus is coming soon, he's coming, it's near, etc. No, it really was literally near. And then Jesus did come in the year 70, and that's what the scriptures do speak of, and it's the destruction of Jerusalem. You just think, if that's the case, then a whole lot of other things have to change. A whole lot of other biblical positions have to change. And in the vast majority of cases, this preterist view also leads to a hard replacement theology, one that no longer sees a clear future for Israel, one that no longer sees future promises for Israel, one that disdains, even mocks, the idea that there is a land promise for Israel, that God's dealing with the Jewish people in the world today has anything to do with the fulfillment of Scripture. So there's a radical paradigm shift that comes with preterism. So, Brock, you had studied these things enough that, what, 5-6 years ago, you were ready to publish a whole book on preterism. So you've been studying as an insider. You've been listening to Gary DeMar and Kenneth Gentry and R.C. Sproul and Hank Hanegraaff and N.T. Wright and others. You become convinced of the position, and then something happened. What was it?
Yeah, so, I mean, eventually I became more of a consistent preterist. I became, a full preterist after studying, Ed Stevens and Don Preston, really looking at their arguments that were aimed to bring partial preterists into full preterism. And, really was resistant to that view, knowing that it was heterodox or kind of against what Orthodox Christianity has always taught and held to regarding the return of Jesus. And so I reluctantly went into more of a full preterist viewpoint.
Now, tell our audience the difference between a full preterist viewpoint and a partial preterist, just in the simplest of terms that you can.
Sure. Okay, so a partial preterist believes that basically the book of Revelation, at least the first 19 chapters, and most, if not all, of the Olivet Discourse that Jesus gave, the final sermon before his death, that those were fulfilled in the first century, and it's the coming of the Son of Man, when Jesus and Son of Man, that they were referring
to. Tell you what, I apologize, but I am losing maybe 50% of what you're saying. We may have to reschedule this interview with my apologies, sir, if there's not a landline that we can do this from. If I'm losing you, the audience is losing you, and this is a really, really important subject. So if we have to reschedule, we'll do that. That's going to be far better than having everyone frustrated because they can't hear much of what you're saying. So allow me, sir, to do a quick promo of your book, and then my team will get with you to reschedule, and we can do this from a landline somewhere and make sure that the quality of our connection is high. I often do radio interviews on my cell phone. That's the only alternative, but sometimes it hasn't worked. So we will have to reschedule. But friends, the book Debunking Preterism is a really important read, okay? I didn't read every word of it. I read much of it. I read it carefully. And I just want to tell you this candidly. For some years now, I've been feeling that I needed to write a book. I titled it Refuting Preterism, or Preterism Refuted, so it would be past tense in the title. And I was planning on doing it at some point, thinking, okay, I know the arguments, but I'm going to have to really master the literature, look at what all the key authors had to say, get into things in much, much greater depth. So invest some months to really doing that, and then writing it in the simplest, clearest terms I could as something potentially dangerous that needed to be addressed. And then I found out about this book. I was contacted about it. Dr. Walter Kaiser gave it a high recommendation, one of the most highly esteemed evangelical Old Testament scholars. Some other folks that I respect really took the book seriously. So I started to get into it, and I thought, okay, first thing he understands, this is before I read his background. This is, I dove in at different parts of the book, so this was before I read Dr. Hollett's background, that he fully embraced this and was about to publish it. I thought, okay, he knows the literature. He knows the arguments. He knows where people are coming from. He knows what the issues are. He's presenting good quote, not like a line here and a line there, but paragraphs and chunks, position after one after another. He understands the arguments, and he's doing a great job of responding to them scripturally and underscoring the error inherent in those positions. And you have to understand that this was not the position of the early church leaders, okay? That doesn't say everything, all right? Obviously, we're going to have differences with different people. Scripture is what we live by. But there's a reason that this view was not the view of the disciples, of the apostles, among other things. So I really encourage you to get the book. We will reschedule with Dr. Hollett when we're able to, when he has a landline connection. And I want to invite all those who hold to full or partial preterism, but full preterism in particular, to call in. We'll announce it. We'll give you advance notice to call in when you have when that show will air, and then you'll be able to raise your objections, raise your issues. But in the meantime, let me encourage all of you, get the book. You can get it on Amazon. I'm not sure where else it's available. Debunking Preterism, How Overrealized Eschatology Misses the Not Yet of Bible Prophecy. It's nuanced. And here and there, we're all going to have a verse or an aspect of interpretation. We have a different take on it. But I'm saying this is soundly laying out key position after key position and underscoring the danger of preterism. Okay, we'll make a shift and we'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. All those tuning in for my interview with Dr. Brock Hollett on his new book, Debunking Preterism. We did not have a good phone line connection. We were unable to get that corrected, so we're going to reschedule. I absolutely want to reschedule and have this important discussion. I did an interesting kind of debate with Dr. Gary DeMar, and there are many things Dr. DeMar and I would agree on, and then areas where we have strong disagreement. We did a debate. It was a debate of sorts in that Dr. DeMar said he was happy to have a debate with me, but not in a formal way, not in a formal, okay, X amount of time exactly, presentation, rebuttal, cross-examination. It was more free-flowing. And it was videotaped, but the videotape did not come out to adequate quality. So we have the audio up on our website. So if you just go to AskDrBrown.org and click in our digital library, search for DeMar. If you search for Brown, you'll find a whole lot of Brown because we got a lot of stuff there. Search for DeMar, D-E-M-A-R. And I think you'll find it very helpful. I think you'll find it helpful and useful. Also, I did a couple of debates with Dr. Don Preston, whom I would say is a more radical preterist than Dr. DeMar. We did a couple of debates on Romans 11, on all Israel shall be saved, and the fullness of the Gentiles. So by all means, check those out. So search for Preston, search for DeMar. If you're over on our YouTube channel at Ask Dr. Brown, then by all means, check that out. We've got all of the videos up there. Also, My debate with Dr. Theodore Zacharias is on our YouTube channel on the Gifts of the Spirit, Have They Ceased? That was last Friday. We're getting lots of good response to that. And my mini debate with Dr. Munter Isaac in Bethlehem last month on replacement theology, which is absolutely relevant to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, that's up as well. Now, let me explain. It really was a mini debate. It was not a full-blown debate, and I'm sure Dr. Isaac or Isak would be very happy to, as far as I know, to do a full-blown debate because he feels confident in his position as I feel confident in mine. But what we did is we agreed whatever time he took to set the stage for his position, I would then give an opening presentation setting the stage for mine. It was supposed to be 10, 12 minutes. He went 14, so I went 14. And then we did brief responses, 5-5. And Dr. Gary Burge, New Testament professor, who also is a replacement theology adherent, he might call it fulfillment or inclusion theology, he moderated, and it was great to have him moderating. And then we had a little back and forth, but then it was mainly Q&A from the audience, and that's what we wanted to be sure we had. And there are a lot of pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist and pro-replacement theology folks there in the audience. We did it twice, and Dr. Isak told me the second time with a smile that basically the vast majority of the audience was with him on that, which is great. I get to speak with them. So it wasn't a full-blown debate where we get to probe each other more and challenge each other more in Scripture. That happened in some of the Q&A, which we don't have online. But check it out. You'll find that enlightening and helpful as well. Okay, so Here's the deal. Because we just made a sudden change in the midst of our live radio broadcast, rather than fighting through a bad audio connection that would only frustrate everyone and would not give justice to the subject or do justice to the subject, because of that, the phone lines are now open for any Jewish-related question you have of any kind, any Hebrew-related question, any question having to do with Messianic prophecy, Jewish roots of the New Testament, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, any and all of the above. Phone lines now open, 866-348-7884. I'm also going to check on Twitter. And if you post a Jewish question on Twitter, I'll try to respond. Or as I look over at my YouTube chat, friends watching on YouTube, if you have a Jewish-related question, so it fits for Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, go ahead and post it, and I'll see if I can get to some of your questions there. Palestinian Media Watch, palwatch.org, does just that. This is based in Israel. Itamar Marcus leads this, and it watches Palestinian media. What is Fatah posting on its Facebook page? What is Hamas airing on its TV station? What is the Palestinian Authority saying here? And it watches Palestinian media, and then it reports on what's being said. This is a report from today. Look at this. With our skulls, we are paving the path to certain victory. This is a Palestinian Authority TV host who quoted arch-terrorist Abu Jihad. Abu Jihad, the very name, father of Jihad, Abu Jihad. So this is someone famous in Palestinian lore as an arch-terrorist, arch-enemy of Israel, many Jewish lives, the blood of many Jewish lives on his hands. Quote, with our skulls, we are paving the path to certain victory. The article says, when the Palestinians marked the anniversary earlier this year of the death of arch-terrorist Abu Jihad, who was responsible for the murder of at least 125 Israelis, a PA host quoted the terrorist encouraging death for Palestine. 30 years since the death as a martyr, and it goes on from there. The first bullet and the first stone. On this day, we remember what Prince of Martyrs, this is Palestinian Authority television, what Prince of Martyrs, Abu Jihad, said, our heads will remain in the sky and our feet are planted in the homeland. With our skulls, we are paving the path to certain victory and return. The compass will never err and the path will continue to guide towards Palestine. Friends, when I was at Christ at the Checkpoint, I urge my Palestinian Christian friends there, and they are not representative of all Palestinian Christians, all right? It's a diverse group like anywhere else. But I urge them to distance themselves publicly from statements like this, to say, this is not our heart. This is not who we are. Their response is, we've done that many times. We deplore all acts of violence. And as I've said many times, that doesn't cut it. In other words, anyone can say that in general. For example, if Israelis are guilty of an act of terrorism, say some settlers decide they're going to get revenge, and they're guilty of an act of terrorism against a Palestinian teenager, and that's just what it is, an act of terrorism, and they kill the kid and burn him alive, all right? I don't get on the air and say, I renounce all acts of violence by the Israelis, by the Palestinians, by Hamas, but no. I say, that's deplorable. That is horrific. That stands against every value we have as Jews. That stands against every value of the modern state of Israel. That stands against every value I have as a follower of Jesus. I go on and on and on. The Israeli government, others in Israel, would renounce it, okay, categorically. We renounce all acts of violence. No, that doesn't cut it. Why not say, and maybe I'll write an article on this, a perfect opportunity for my Palestinian Christian friends, to just say specifically, we deplore this. We renounce this. And that you say, well, what would that do? I'll tell you what it would do. It would tell Christians in the West that Palestinian Christians are Christian first and Palestinian second. In other words, if some American soldier committed an atrocity in Iraq, he lost it one day, one of his friends was killed, and he goes into a marketplace and, God forbid, he shoots and kills unarmed civilians, children, women, I'd get up. Americans across the world would get up and say, that is unacceptable, that is horrific, that is shameful. We need to make reparations. We, of course, can't bring lives back. That's un-American. That's contrary to our military ethic. That violates everything we stand for. It's deplorable. We renounce it, and we're going to have to do better. We understand our servicemen are risking their lives. We understand they lose a lot. But the very reason they're in the military is to save lives and protect lives of the innocent, not to take the lives of the innocent. We'd be able to say something like that. So it is so important for our Palestinian Christian friends to send a message that we are followers of Jesus first. They are followers of Jesus first and Palestinian second. And to the extent they are identified with the Palestinian Authority, to the extent they are identified with Fatah, to the extent they issue statements in sympathy with Hamas rather than in sympathy with Israel, whatever the case might be, to that extent it's very difficult for Christians in the West to stand with them and get behind them. I'm not saying it's a condition of fellowship or friendship. I'm saying it's a condition of standing together. And that was my message, a big part of my message there at Christ at the Checkpoint. And I appreciate the response that was written to my article that did not respond angrily to my article saying that the people were warmer than I expected, the positions worse than I expected. And while I did not find any of the leaders themselves to be anti-Semites, I found the conference itself to be a seedbed of anti-Semitism. Thankfully, they said, look, we do have differences, strong differences, and we don't feel we were properly represented, etc. However, let's pursue friendship and dialogue. I appreciated that. And in that spirit, I say what I say, not to hurt, but to help. As I quoted in English, Hebrew, and Arabic while I was there, the wounds of a friend are faithful. The kisses of an enemy are profuse. Okay, we come back. I'm going straight to your Jewish-related questions. 866-348-7884.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I had announced recently, put out word on social media, that I'd be interviewing Dr. Brock Hollett about his new book, Debunking Preterism. It's a must-read. This is a man who was about to publish a book on preterism when he felt the Lord nudge him, re-examine this, go back to Scripture. And he realized that he had built his edifice on a house of cards or a house of sand, with all respect to preterists. We started the interview a half hour ago, but we had a bad phone connection we couldn't resolve. So we're looking to reschedule. But, hey, it's live radio. So we quickly did what we often do on Thursdays, which is open up the phones for any Jewish-related question that you have. 866-34-TRUTH. I'm going to go to the phones momentarily. But here's a Twitter question from Jessica. Ben Shapiro, who I love, by the way, states that Jews do not believe in life after death. Didn't Jesus clear that up when he answered his fellow Jews that God said, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he is the God of the living, not the dead? Jessica, great question, great point. Number one, a traditional Jew, or even a non-traditional Jew, would not base his or her view on the afterlife on the teaching of Jesus. You see, yeah, but Jesus really opened up with the Torah. It says it was an amazing insight by the Son of God, but one that others would pass by. Thinking, yeah, he's the God of the past generations as opposed to the God of the living. And what Ben was saying represents traditional Jewish thinking to a point. In other words, the emphasis is not on the afterlife as you might find in certain Christian circles, as in get saved and go to heaven. That would not be a Jewish focus. A Jewish focus would be on this world, but rabbinic sources say that this world is the vestibule to the world to come. So there is that recognition, and you have the messianic era, and then the resurrection of the dead, and the eternal age. And the eternal age basically would be spent obeying God, learning Torah, and those kinds of things. But there's not as big an emphasis on it. And if you'll go to a traditional Jewish funeral, you'll find much more mourning and grieving because of the loss of this person in this world. As opposed to a Christian funeral, you'll often have a note of victory or celebration or joy in the midst of the pain, especially with an older person, because they've gone on to their reward, they've gone on to be with the Lord. That being said, the Talmud does teach that there are some people who are totally wicked, and they go down, and they don't come back up. In other words, hell forever. And there are some who are totally righteous, and they just go straight up. You know, the rarest of the rare of the rare, who is so righteous, they don't have any sins to be purged. But the rest go down and then come up. And that's what Ben was referring to. It's kind of a purgatory type of thing, that after death, a Jewish person could go through some type of suffering for up to 11 months, purging of sin or purification or payment of sin. It is certainly not an exact parallel to purgatory and Catholicism, but similar. And then after that would go on to the enjoyable afterlife. So I would say that there would be some nuancing to what Ben said. As I heard the clip in question, I thought, yeah, well, I would object to this. But he's learned and well enough aware of these things that I think was speaking in terms of general beliefs. 866-34-TRUTH. We start in Arlington, Texas. Bryson, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. I was just calling to ask about, like, it's a translation issue in the Hebrew Scripture, mm-hmm. So maybe it's not really an issue, but just something I've ran across as an objection.
Yeah.
Isaiah 9:6, where it speaks about, for us a child is born, to us a son is given. That Hebrew phrase there, like, I don't know Hebrew very well, but the son being given, I guess, is a verb tense that, when translated elsewhere in Genesis 4:26. To Seth, also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. I've heard that, mm-hmm. You know, somebody tried to say that this is an inconsistency within the translation, which is trying to kind of read back a prophecy that really
isn't at all. It's not inconsistent at all. It's simply recognizing what scholars and traditional rabbis call the prophetic perfect, meaning it's using a past tense for a future event. In fact, on our Real Messiah broadcast last night, our Jewish outreach show that we do on Wednesday nights from 9 to 10 through New York City and then online, I actually touched on this because I was looking at Numbers 24:17. Do you have a Bible handy anywhere?
Yeah, okay. I have it right in front of me.
All right, so go to Numbers chapter 24, verse 17, and just start reading the beginning of that verse when you find it. What translation are you reading from?
The English Standard Version.
Okay, ESV, fine, English translation. So Numbers 24, 17, what does it say?
I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel.
Okay, so the word shall come forth or shall come out, shall rise up, those are in the past in Hebrew. And yet, the context is telling you it's future. I see him. I see this coming, but not yet. It's still future. So Rashi, the foremost biblical and Talmudic commentator in Judaism, the most respected, lived from 1040 to 1105 in France, he uses this as an example of what we call the prophetic perfect. The verb is in the past, but it's speaking of something in the future. And then, as a further reference, he references and discusses this in Isaiah chapter 42, verse 16. He gives the exact same phenomenon there, which is talking about things God's going to do in the future, and it says, I've done them in the past. And then another example would be Ibn Ezra, who was a little bit after Rashi and was maybe the second or third most respected biblical commentator in Judaism. And in dealing with Jonah chapter 2, verse 2, he says the Hebrew is past tense, but it's speaking about something that was still going to happen in the immediate future, or in some cases it can apply to the distant future. So there are two possibilities here, Bryson. Number one, no big deal, prophetic perfect. It uses something in the past, reporting on it as if it already happened. So picture in prophetic vision, I see it and I say, a child has been born, a son has been given, wow. So you see it as if it already happened, okay? It'd be like I take you in the future and I show you the birth of one of your children, a child, it's a boy, etc. You see it as if it's already happened. So that's not uncommon in prophetic literature, and Hebrew grammarians, rabbis, Christian scholars, everybody agrees on it. The other possibility is the prophecy was spoken with the birth of Hezekiah, with all these glorious prophecies spoken over him because he was next in line to the Davidic throne that had the messianic promises, but like many others before him, the promises fell short and they find their fulfillment in Jesus the Messiah. They obviously weren't fulfilled in the life of Hezekiah or any Old Testament king of that time. So either prophetic perfect grammatically, speaking of the future as if it already happened, everyone agrees that that occurs. Isaiah 53 is a perfect example of it. The prophet speaks of the death and resurrection of Jesus in the past, even though it's still in the future. Or it was about Hezekiah initially, these promises spoken to the Davidic heir, but they find their fulfillment in the Messiah because they obviously didn't find fulfillment in Hezekiah. Thank you, sir, for the question. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Deborah in Minnesota. Thank you for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I am just deeply concerned about the peace process with the Trump team and Kushner and Greenblatt. I'm actually on a 40-day fast at the very end of it, and I'm just really asking if we could even ask your listeners to just be seeking the Lord, to be praying. This is so dangerous. And I have heard you recently kind of make, it sounds like you've been looking into this further, and I've heard you make some comments, but I guess I'm looking for some clarity of where you stand on the peace plan and
right.
The danger of judgment.
Yeah, so where what concerns you in terms of being the most dangerous?
Just because of, like Joel 3, where it talks about the Lord will judge nations who divide up the land.
Yeah, so I just wrote a chapter in a new book on that, edited by Daryl Bach and Mitch Glazer, about the land of Israel. And that I did for the first time in my life a really in-depth study of the subject of dividing the land. And in the context of Joel 3, it's talking about nations that basically conquer Israel and then carve it up between themselves. It's a very different context as opposed to saying two-state solution versus one-state solution. So the big thing is that throughout Scripture, God says, it's my land, it's my land, it's my land, it's my inheritance. And that's why we need to tread carefully here. I don't know which way.
This is my concern because, I mean, what I feel like the Lord is kind of speaking to me through the scriptures is that since it is his land that makes it holy, so like if this were two other nations in some other land, you know, maybe we could be like dividing up Jerusalem, or, you know.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, but look, let's also remember that Tel Aviv just had a gay pride event with 250,000 people.
Right.
That, you know, that there's unholiness every single day in Israel. So Israel's there by grace, not by works.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Largely, you know, a lot of the prayers of believers. So listen, I don't know exactly which way this is going to go. There are concerns. You know, Saudi Arabia wants to get involved. And just looking at an article that says Hamas could even be, I mean, how in the world that would work out, I don't know. But there's some saying, look, Palestinian Authority is not cooperating and we're going to go ahead and do something. I know that all the attempts for peace in the past have failed. And Oslo Accords, and you go to hand Yasser Arafat a total victory, and instead he launches a series of suicide bombings and things like that. I don't know what to expect where things are going. So, Deborah, I absolutely honor your burden and deeply appreciate that in the midst of prayer and fasting, you're lifting this up before the Lord. Candidly, I don't think there will be any lasting peace before the Lord returns. If it does come, it will be a pseudo-peace. In other words, it may well be that things seem to go well for a decade or 20 or 30 years or 5 years. I don't know. It could well be that things seem to go well, and then sudden destruction, then battle. You know, hence the Ezekiel 38:39 Gog and Magog passage where Israel's dwelling in unwalled cities, and you think, yeah, there are walls and fences up, everything seems fine, then the attack comes, but then, of course, God fights for his people. So I would just really pray for America's good, for Israel's good. God, your best plan, because I don't know when certain things are supposed to unfold or how. God, your best plan for Israel, for the surrounding nations, for America. May your best come to pass for the maximum number of people to come to know you and for the shedding of minimum blood. Your best, Father. And that's sometimes the only way I know how to pray. Lord, your kingdom come to the Middle East. Your will be done. Thanks for your prayer and concern.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I want to get right back to the phones, but first, I just got to give you this little news item. Memory TV, so this is Middle East Media Research Institute. So this looks at sermons, media throughout the Middle East. So how about this? A sermon this past Friday, Damascus Friday sermon by Dr. Muhammad Ali Al-Mala. The World Cup implements the protocols of the Elders of Zion by distracting the Muslims from the bloodshed in Gaza. Ah, this poor soul. You got to be kidding me. The World Cup scheduled every 4 years, right? World soccer, world football, captivating nations across the world. So this is now following the protocols of the Elders of Zion, this alleged master plan of Jews to take over the world, which is just a forgery of Russian secret police from 100-something years ago. In any case, this is the plan, you see, that the World Cup is being scheduled now, and this distracts from the bloodshed. Well, hang on. The bloodshed in Gaza is what got scheduled by Hamas to be taking place in coordination with the 70th anniversary of Israel, and then stepped things up with the moving of the embassy. So it's Hamas that set this up. Unless you think the Jews are smart enough that they plan this out to have the World Cup. Oh, so the World Cup every 4 years, that's been going on for a while. So the Jews would have had to plan it out like many decades ago to make the whole thing work. Oh, yeah, that's how smart they are. I mean, oh, God help us. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to Miguel in South Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire. Are you there?
Greetings, Dr. Brown.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Just speak right in the phone, sir.
Yes, sir. I have a question
on the Abrahamic blessing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people on the alt-right, specifically there's a channel called Jews for Hitler, they got taken down. I've been researching what they've been saying, and they say basically that if you follow the Abrahamic blessing, Abraham gave the blessing to Isaac, and then Isaac gave it to Jacob, and then Jacob had the 12 sons, and one of the, and he did not pass on the Abrahamic blessing to Judah, the house of Judah, but instead to Joseph, and then from there Ephraim and Manasseh, and then from there they claim, the alt-right kind of people claim other things, but I was just wondering
what's up with that. So the Abrahamic blessing is through his seed, the entire world would be blessed. That's Jesus, the Messiah, ultimately fulfills that, right? So okay. He is of the line of Judah, in the line of, and specifically the family of David, tribe of Judah, line of David. So that demolishes that. That's number one, and the New Testament fully affirms that. Number two, the promise whoever blesses you is blessed, whoever curses you is cursed, is spoken by Balaam in this week's Torah portion, Numbers 22-24. He speaks that over the nation of Israel as a whole. So the promised blessing applies to the nation as a whole. Those who bless Israel are blessed. Those who curse Israel are cursed. The nation as a whole, which is preserved primarily in the descendants of Judah. And the problem, the promise to bring blessing to all the nations through Abraham's seed finds its fulfillment in Jesus the Messiah, who comes through the line of David and the tribe of Judah. So this is just complete bunk, nonsense, just heresy put to anti-Semitism. Is all that it is. All right. But thanks for that. I wasn't even aware of that. But thank you for asking. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Joy in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Good afternoon, Dr. Brown.
Oh, hello. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Brown. I have a question. Yeah. My husband and I just recently booked the upcoming tour to Israel in February 2019, and I just feel that there's so much stirring in my heart, and this was a really big deal. We never thought that we'd be able to, in this season of our life, be able to go, and it's not just a quick vacation. It's just something so deeply important to us and part of our journey. And I was wondering, how can we prepare? Do you have any thoughts of how we can prepare? I mean, it's still about 8 months away.
Yeah.
First, I'm
thrilled. Yeah, I'm thrilled that you and your husband will be going. And friends, you can find out about the trip. We still do have room. AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org, right on the homepage. Find out about the trip to Israel February 1st through 10th, really the trip of a lifetime. So I'm thrilled that you'll be going. The first thing is every day, whenever you think of it, I just pray, Lord, prepare our hearts for this trip to have maximum lasting impact, because there's a ton that happens that you take in while you're there. I wouldn't try to read up and learn, because you'll get immersed when you're there. You'll have a great tour guide. You'll have my friend Scott there, and I'll be there at key sites. And then every night we'll be doing stuff together. So I wouldn't try to like read up a lot. And you know what I do is just on a regular basis, just be praying and saying, God, prepare our hearts. That's one thing. Then as you actually get closer, the key things that you want to make sure that you do your best is sleep as much as you can while traveling, and then once you're there, make sure you do your best to sleep well every night, because with body clock being different, 7 hours difference in time and things like that, it's very easy to be excited, be up in the middle of the night, then you're tired during the day because it's a full, wonderful tour. So what I do, you know, I've traveled internationally well over 160 trips and sometimes hit the ground and have to speak immediately. I always bring a mild sleeping pill or something like that, so that the first 3 nights or so, I take it every night a little bit before bedtime to help me to sleep through the night. And then you get up more rested in the morning. If you wake up in the middle of the night, you're better able to go back to sleep. So that'd be a big thing. But otherwise, you're going to have the time of your life. All you have to do is show up and be there. And I will absolutely look forward to meeting you and your husband. What's your husband's first name?
My husband's first name is Bill. And another reason why this trip is so special to us is that we're celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary. We've been married to each other only by the grace of God.
Wow. Okay.
For that long, and it's just, and I'm already when I first booked it, I had a couple of those sleepless nights because of the excitement. But
yeah.
We don't want it just to be about us. It's not just about us too. It's about praying for the lost. And
oh yeah, no, trust me. What you do is just drink everything in when you're there. That's the key thing, and then you will have many years to absorb it, live it out afterwards. But we will look forward to celebrating that time with you. So wonderful. And friends, it really is. It's great accommodations, great tour bus. It's a trip of a lifetime. It really, really is. I am so excited to get this call. Thank you, Joy. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's see if we've got time for another caller to Yusuf in California. Welcome to the Line of Fire. Are you there?
Well, yes. Thank you so much. I'm part of this church called International Christian Church,
mm-hmm.
and we hold these Bible studies pretty often within the week. And
yep.
I'm just trying to prepare myself because I know for sure someone either from like the Jewish faith or maybe in Muslim faith, Islamic faith, would bring up Mark 10:18, which
yep.
says if they're trying to like disprove Jesus being God in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
He'll bring it up, which says, why do you call me good? Jesus answered, no one is good except God alone.
Yep.
So how would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's the exact opposite of what people are thinking. Elsewhere, for example, John 10, Jesus said of himself, he's the good shepherd, right? So he calls uh-huh. himself good there. And then, for example, yeah. in John 15, he says, I'm the true vine. So he describes himself as good and true. And elsewhere as the truth. So his point is, you have no idea who you're talking to. You're trying to flatter me, but you don't even realize who you're talking to. There's only one that's good, that's God. And God incarnate is standing right in front of you. So it's the opposite of, rather than being a polemic against the deity of Jesus, it actually points right in that direction.
Yeah, okay. So would you say that the reason why he asked this question to the rich man was because he was a Jewish person that said, you know, good teacher. Was he basically trying to say, you know, you're Jewish and like the rabbis are claiming that I'm not God in the flesh, and then here you are calling me good, and then according to the Old Testament says, you know, no one is good except God alone.
Yeah, I think that's a valid line of reasoning, but it goes a little too far. In other words, the primary battle when Jesus was in the world was about him being the Messiah. The idea of him being the Word made flesh was true, but somewhat in the background and only comes up in hints and sayings like in John 5 or John 8 or John 10 or things like that. So it's not that there is this battle. I'm saying I'm God in the flesh. You're saying I'm not. Because what does that even mean? In other words, it's the mm-hmm. Word made flesh. The Father remains enthroned in heaven, etc. So I think more than anything, he's exposing this young man. You're a flatterer. You're sincere because, you know, it says Jesus loved him, right? It was a burden for him, you know, but you don't even realize who you're dealing with. You don't even realize what the real issues are. And I think it's just a way of pushing back, even though the man wouldn't have understood. He would not have taken him to mean, am I talking to God himself? He just pushes him back and gets him thinking. And then out of that, of course, Jesus reveals the truth and shows him he's got to leave everything, follow him. In other words, to truly live out his faith, he's got to put his trust in the one and only Savior and Lord. Hey, we're out of time. Thanks, friends, for your great calls today. We'll be back with you. You've got questions. We've got answers.